and welcome to the Nibbies podcast. Conversations with authors who've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards, lovingly known as the Nibbies. I'm your host and longtime Nibbies fan, Hannah McInnes. These awards celebrate books and everyone who makes them, honouring the entire creative, collaborative journey of a book, from the author's mind to the reader's hand. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. Chat to some of today's best-loved authors about their books, their writing, what's gone on behind the scenes to get them to where they are, and those lovely moments when they and the books they've created have found their readers.
I'm Philippa Gregory. I'm a writer, I'm a historian and a fiction writer, and I'm the author of Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History, a history of the women of England.
Tell us about Normal Women. As you say, 900 years, no small amount of making history. It's evidently an enormous labour of love, I'm assuming love, because of how much of effort will have gone into it. So why were you so committed to telling these stories and why you felt the world needed this?
I'd answered for some years the question about my fictional books that are based on real women, where people say, how did you find her? That there's no biography about her, perhaps, or she appears absolutely in the margins, in the shadows of history. And I had always said, oh, well, I look and I find an interesting woman. And then as I'm reading about women, another woman sort of pops up. So I was tracking individuals through the historical record. And it occurred to me, it seemed like really a eureka moment, but really, why so long? Why did it take you so long to realise that it wasn't that there are these individual extraordinary women who are neglected by history, but that all women are neglected by history. The extraordinary thing is getting into the history if you're a woman. And then I started looking at history in an upside down sort of way. So if we looked at a historical period and said, not what are the big events being done by men, but what are women doing in their normal lives in a completely ordinary way, and started looking at history from that point of view. And then what you find even more extraordinary is that it is women who are literally doing extraordinary things, but they're never recognised for doing it. So it is women who are running the castles and setting up trades and inventing things and discovering things. There are women artists and musicians and composers and scientists. There are certainly women revolutionaries. There are women leading riots and, you know, being absolutely in the vanguard of political change. But when the history comes to be written, the story is told from the point of view of the man who is sometimes helping them, the man at their side, and not the woman who's initiating it. Mm.
Those things you just described, leading riots, all of them, they are extraordinary. And I think you used the word extraordinary as well. They are extraordinary women. So why normal women?
Because extraordinary is normal for normal women. Everyday lives, which women undertake, they undertake extraordinary acts, which you would think would get them into the history books, but it doesn't. It only gets them into the history books if it, in a sense, aligns with the history that we already know. So if they are seen as someone helping a man to do a historic act, then they sometimes get their name in. Or if they're seen as leading a reform or a change, which is particularly aligned to the idea of what women's behaviour. So women carers, women nurses get into the record. Women abolitionists, abolition of slavery, they get into the record because what they're doing is they're extending the white middle class home out into the world. So people who are engaged in caring or in making a change for the better for women and children, they get their names into the record. But women who are leading the peasants' revolt against the king to end slavery, or at the front of all of the riots for food, which made the 18th century a hotbed of rebellious activity, their names don't only come into the record when they're at their criminal trials, because they don't suit the historian's idea of women's behaviour.
To find those names must have been the most enormous amount of research. You say they popped out when you were researching other things, but you must have really had to delve, because you are one of the first to find these women. They have been lost to history. I didn't learn about them.
No. They've been lost to, in a sense, popular history. They've been lost to schools' history. They've been lost probably to universities' undergraduate history. But if you're a specialist medieval historian, you know these stories and you have published them. So what I was doing was a great deal of research in very, very little read books, very arcane books, in some cases by authors whose name you wouldn't recognise at all, and often also authors who are not read now. So Victorian authors or 18th century historians whose books are not read now and whose work has largely been forgotten. So it was not original research. I was not in the fields of Suffolk turning over the mud to find original artifacts. I would love to claim that, but it wasn't that. It was literally in libraries among published books where great historians have done very, very detailed, very minuscule, very beautiful, detailed research work, which has disappeared into books and they've not been read.
Does that frustrate you enormously that you had to do that in 2024?
It's such a privilege. It couldn't frustrate me. I am so grateful to the wonderful historians who've come before me, who have been the ones who've been going through the documents and in the archives and finding these criminal trials and pulling them together and seeing the thread that runs through them is women's, you know, courageous women's criminal behaviour. So I'm very, very grateful to that. But what I really notice is that the way we teach history, the way we study history these days is in silos. So it's in periods. So there are no historians working in a university, as far as I know, who do, as my book does, 900 years of history. That's not how we study history now. So you have medieval historians who know all there is to know about women in the medieval period. And you have, say, 18th century historians who know all about women in the 18th century period. But there isn't anybody looking at the route from the one to the other. At the moment, because that's not how we do history at the moment, which is why, in a sense, there was, in a way, a vacuum that I wanted to fill. I wanted for people to not have to go into these, you know, detailed archives and you know, distant libraries, to see that there is a line that connects us now in the modern world to women in the medieval world, and that sometimes they are more like us in the problems they face and the solutions they bring than maybe Victorian women, who are, in a sense, more unlike us than our medieval great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers.
When I say frustrated, I mean extraordinary and so sad that their stories have been so lost and how seminal they are to our understanding of history and who we are now. Tell us about those parallels then. For example, you write about when there was first gender pay equality. When was that? Listeners might be quite surprised.
I'll actually give you a moment to guess it. When do we think was the first equal pay for women? 1349. Extraordinary. And it was gone in 50 years. So it occurred in 1349 because the plague had wiped out so many of the workforce that employers had to pay good rates for a worker, and they didn't care if it was a man or a woman, because in any case, men and women were working at an equal level of strength and ability in all of the jobs that were being done then, because there was no sense that particularly dirty, unpleasant or caring jobs had to be done by women. There was an understanding that there was so much work to be done, everybody had to do it. And everybody was paid equally until the balance of the population changed and there were more workers looking for jobs, in which case employers literally set in maximum pay limits so they didn't have to pay everybody a good wage and they could especially underpay women. And that's been the tradition. Underpaying women has been a tradition from the 14th century, and not even legislation has put that right. We are still, as women, paid on average 75% of the male wage. And I just want to catch you on one thing there. You use the word seminal, which I think is so interesting. I always use now the word oval. So what is the starting point? What is the key creative moment? It's not a seminal moment. It's an oval moment. It's about eggs, not sperm.
I'm so grateful for that correction, which I shall take into my future conversations. Very important. I mean, there's so many surprising things, and you must, I'm sure, in your research have had these eureka moments about the pay equality so long ago, and also women priests. I mean, we celebrate now, we think, oh, it's so exciting, we're just getting there. And actually, you discover it happened a long, long time ago.
Again, it's in the plague years, where in the Roman Catholic Church, which makes it even more extraordinary, the Bishop of Bath announced that if a man was dying and there was no priest to give him extreme unction and for him to make his confession, then he could confess to a layman, to someone who wasn't ordained. And if he couldn't find a layman to confess to, even to a woman, is the phrase. So women were representing God to a dying man, and they had the authority, they were given the authority to do so. And that mattered enormously in a very, very religious, very, very spiritual conscious society. But it really matters to us today, because it's in a sense, it's the last frontier. When the church said that women could not and should not be ordained, which went on as late as the 1960s, but there's a really big conference about it in about the 1920s. And the church says that women cannot be ordained because God did not choose, Jesus did not choose women disciples. Now, we now know that he actually did, but at the time, people preferred to ignore that. And that matters so much because it says that women's nature is inferior. Their spiritual nature, their souls are inferior to male souls. And breaking through that was the last formal decision that women should be unequal. Interestingly enough, the church changed their teaching on it to say that women could be ordained as priests and ultimately ordained as bishops, but they retained their legal right to sex discrimination inside the church. So the church is the only institution in modern England that can legally discriminate against women on the basis of their sex. Isn't that outrageous?
Yeah, I feel like maybe an alternative book you could have written along, a diary of your journey in writing this book would have been an interesting one to read. Why did you decide to write this as a work of nonfiction? Because, of course, you always put women centre stage in your fiction who otherwise might go unknown. Why was it important to tell this as a work of nonfiction?
This really is my life's work. You know, I write about women because I care about women's history and because their stories really speak to me as a woman. But to be able to say to the world, and particularly to the women of England, we have been denied our history. We don't know where we came from. We don't know the lives of our mothers or our grandmothers. If you're a man in England and you open a history book, you have an absolute model of yourself on every page. Because, for example, in Winston Churchill's English Speaking People, he says that's a history in the title. He claims it's a history of the English speaking peoples. It's, I think, 6 volumes in most editions. And there are thousands, literally thousands, of named men, and there are 93 named women in 6 volumes. Mm-hmm. And most of them are there as somebody's mother or somebody's wife. Mm-hmm. There's very few who are there on their own account. If you read, therefore, a long-form history like that, you could genuinely believe that the world is not half women. Mm-hmm. It's like 0.2% women. It's, you know, there's almost no women in history at all. And the only way to correct that was to write a history in which women are 99.9% of the subject. I deliberately don't mention men at every opportunity where I can avoid naming a man. I avoid naming a man because they've had enough names in enough histories.
Yeah, and I understand for the same reason you don't structure it by the reigns of kings.
Exactly. And the Reigns of Kings is absolutely useless in terms of giving you any idea of social trends anyway. So the life of a monarch does not create an age. So what I, when I started writing it, and I realized I was going to write chronologically from the invasion of William of Normandy up until the ordination of women, I went, how can I shape this in a way which reflects the female experience? And it fell into quite nice chapters, as it were, in which you have the early imposition of feudalism, which makes such a difference. Then you have the rise of women during the years of the plague. Then you have the pushback that comes after when more people return. And then you have things like the Elizabethan years. It does make a difference, but only because Elizabethan legislation is so powerfully directed to controlling women, keeping them in their villages and keeping them underpaid. Mm. And then you have, literally, it's a story of steps forward and pushback. Mm. And that, tragically, divides quite neatly into sections. So, for instance, whenever there's a war, whether it's the English Civil War, the Wars of the Roses, or the World Wars, women step forward into challenging, profitable, interesting, rewarding work. Mm-hmm. And whenever there's a peace, men take the jobs back and women are returned to the homes.
I could talk to you about the content of the book and your reasons for writing it for a very long time. I was absolutely bowled over by the suffering of the women in the wars of religion. But this podcast is a lot too about the actual publishing journey and about the collaborative experience when it was out of the writing and away from you researching in the libraries and working with the team at HarperCollins. I just wonder if you could reflect on some moments of that experience that are particularly memorable to you.
I think a standout moment for me is when I went in for a meeting with them and HarperCollins told me how they saw the book and how they proposed to take it forward. And they had, my title was A Brief History of Normal Women, which was a sort of joke because it was neither brief. And women are, as you say, extraordinary. I would say normal, but certainly there's that concept of how do you deal with this, this concept of normality when it includes heroism. So, they invented the strapline, 900 years of making history. And I just love that. It really told me that they realized what I was doing and that it had that reference back to, you know, women making history as if it is an act of creation, which you could do like baking bread. So I loved that. And then I suppose another huge moment was when I talked to the jacket designer about my vision for the jacket. And I said I wanted it to be something which was pixelated, which made a picture if you saw it in one light and otherwise you saw the pixels, because it was the history of so many millions of women. I wanted to have the idea of a multitude on the jacket. And he found this wonderful portrait of Mary Edwards by the painter Hogarth, which is itself a beautiful image. She herself is an extraordinary woman. He didn't know what a heroine she was to me, but she is a woman who managed to keep her child and her fortune at a time when divorce would mean that you lost both by the incredibly courageous device of denying her marriage and just saying that she was, in fact, a whore and her son was a bastard. And that way she kept her son and her money from her fraudulent husband. So she's a heroine anyway. And he picked her image almost at random and made it out of pixels of these extraordinary other women whose images are in the book also. And I remember seeing that and going like, this is exactly what I imagined, though I didn't exactly imagine it. And that sense, which is so rare in the world generally, that someone has got what you were trying to say and someone understands what you're trying to do. And that's a revelation, really, I think, for whether you're a writer or just someone trying to explain yourself, to know that someone sees what you're doing. It's very, very rewarding.
I knew she had an extraordinary story, but I didn't know that it was by accident that she appeared on the front. That's wonderful. And I know, I listened to half of it and I read half of it in the hard copy, the audiobook, which I found just a wonderful audio experience. And I know a lot of thought and work went into that.
Yes, the audio team were brilliant with it. That I've never read a book of my own before, because I've always thought, I think in general rightly, that, you know, actors have trained for years and have this talent and these trained skills. And, you know, although I've done quite a lot of radio and I, you know, have done television and voiceover work, I'm a, you know, by trade, I'm a writer. There's no need for me to read my own work. But this was so personal and I felt so passionately about it. I knew I wanted to put in the time and take the direction that I would need. And I went into the audio studio and it was a wonderful team that greeted me that day. And they'd already thought about actors to do the dialogue parts in it, where we've got women's genuine voices from the past. We had that almost a script. So that added tremendous amount of colour to it. We'd already had composed some music and I had briefed what I wanted. And my brief was not a lament. This is not a story of women's defeat. This is a story of women constantly getting up and trying again. Mm. And over time, winning, prevailing. There is literally a battle for women's equality. And over 900 years, we have fought it probably every day. And every day somewhere, someone has won it. And there is a constant pushback, but there's also a constant step forward. So we ended up with this rather jaunty tune, which I was really pleased about. And we then, in a sense, produced it appropriate to the period that we were talking about. So it really changes. It's a theme with variations, but it really changes as the book goes through. And I love that about it as well. And then I had a wonderful experience of reading and being produced as a reader. So they were very, very kind. And every now and then they would stop and say, "You're sounding a bit tired." And I, you know, take a break, eat something lovely, go back in, try again. And literally, I did not expect, but I really, really enjoyed my days in studio because it was making a new version of this book that I love in a way that I had never made a version before. Yeah. So it was a big learning curve for me and a really, really enjoyable exercise. And probably the funniest moment was there are some parts in it which are genuinely moving, whether it's about violence against women or about women's courage in these sometimes extraordinary difficult times. And quite often we would have to stop because I was getting choked up, or you could hear the tears in my voice. And I looked through the glass and there was a production team and they were crying. So we all had to take a little break and, a cup of tea, a little bit of comfort, and then go back in and make sure that what we produced was really clear without ever trying to drain it of that sense of passionate involvement.
Well, you achieved it. It's interesting to hear you say that about the moving nature of it, because I think I was running, listening, and bumped into someone I knew and was very distressed. It does. It's very, very moving and a very powerful listen, of course, as well as read. And what about meeting your readers? I know that you did a number of events, which you often, of course, do with your books. But what about this particular experience of meeting the readers and their reaction to this?
It's been a very different book to take on tour. We had a brilliant tour with it, bigger audiences even than usual, which is interesting, and a genuine sense, I think, of engagement. So it's not, you know, my novels speak very loudly and very personally to my readers, I know, and they come up and they tell me of their experience while reading it. And often those are extraordinary, challenging times for them when they've turned to fiction as a comfort or a distraction or even an escape. But this book, people came up and talked about their grandmother's history or their family history or their own sense of being heirs to this history. And almost everybody has their own life that aligns with it. So almost everybody has had a job that they haven't got and they're pretty sure they didn't get it because they were a woman, or has had an experience where they were unfairly treated because they were a woman, or particularly poignantly, women who have experienced violence. One talk which was, I mean, the audience just went completely silent. And one woman asked me what I would suggest if she could get no help from her partner to raise their children and she had to go out to work, but she couldn't see how she could go out to work because she had nobody to help her with childcare. And literally the audience went silent and I had nothing helpful to say because the state we live in does not support women and particularly single mothers as it should. And if a man chooses not to support his partner and their children, he can do that. Whereas in the medieval world, there'd have been a chorus of women outside his house, you know, singing at midnight, insulting him. It's extraordinary how, in some ways, we have not progressed.
When you hear a woman ask you that at an event, at a book event, how do you think telling the history in this way, women reading the history, can help them now and us now?
I think if you look at it in, if you look at anything, whether it's sexual violence or domestic violence, abuse or just, I say just, it's not just, abuse or neglect or prejudice against women, if you understand that you are not the only person suffering this, I think that helps at once. If you understand that the woman next door to you may be suffering it, even if you aren't, I think that helps us in terms of sisterhood. Mm-hmm. And I think if you understand that this is, in effect, the nature of being a woman in English society, that women have always come up against this and they have always fought against it. And the only way they've ever successfully fought against prejudice against women, however it's manifested, whether domestically with a cruel husband or whether publicly with having no rights in the world, the way we've always fought about it successfully is when we've joined together and when we've seen that basically a poor woman being beaten up by her husband is literally my issue just as much as it is hers, because if he is allowed to do it to her, my husband is allowed to do it to me. There's no such thing as a class division when you look at sisterhood. There's no such thing as a race division when you look at sisterhood. We've really got to make sisterhood a core part of our understanding of how we are in the world. And until we do that, we're not going to make much progress, because men, without having a name for it, unless it's the old boy network, they have absolutely established themselves as dominant in historical societies and as dominant in our societies by understanding that the weakest man has got to be supported if he's letting the side down. And we have to learn that.
Philippa, thank you so much, and thank you for this extraordinary book of normal, extraordinary women. Huge thanks.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to subscribe to the series to hear more conversations with Nibby's authors. And we'd love it if you'd rate it and leave us a review. Do visit thebookseller.com/British-book-awards. To find out more about the industry's biggest celebration of books and all who make them. This podcast was produced by Heavy Entertainment.